So, welcome to Fated Mates, everyone.
Welcome. We are here talking about a fan favorite, Kiss of a Demon King, starring the Sorceress Sabine and the Prince, Demon Prince?
King?
Rydstrom King?
No, Deposed King.
Deposed King, sorry. Deposed King.
It's right there in the title.
For the first time ever, I feel like I'm like, I have got it with this title. Kiss of a Demon King.
It all falls apart, the next one, just FYI.
The one I've been calling Frozen IAD.
Right. Yeah. First of all, I'm Sarah McLean. I write books and I read books.
I'm Jen Reads Romance. I read books. I talk about books with Sarah and pretty much anybody else will talk about books with me, to be honest with you.
And yeah, it's Kiss of the Demon King. I have not gotten this title wrong, not even once.
Nope.
Not even once.
Me neither.
And as you know, it's kind of a thing now. Our producer is constantly saying, you guys, now I'm just leaving in the mistakes on the titles because it's a thing.
I feel like he's going to make a super cut of like two things. One, us fucking up the titles, and two, us trying to clap and like count and clap at the same time. And it'll be comedy gold.
Well, for like 18 people, yes, comedy gold.
But
so yes, Kiss of a Demon King, the title finally matches the book. We are talking about Rydstrom, the deposed king of Rothkalina, the Rage Demon Kingdom. And it's here, the book that everybody wants to talk about. We actually have a guest on this show. Jenny Nordback from the Wicked Wallflowers podcast is joining us for this. But it's interesting because I gotta say, at the risk of everybody in the whole world being mad at me, this is not my favorite IAD book. I mean, unsurprising for everyone. But even if you take Rune, if you take Sweet Ruin out of the running, it's still not my favorite.
It's not my favorite either. I appreciated it so much more the second time around. Mm-hmm. But I felt a little like I was faking it with some people after reading the first time. I was like, oh yeah, everyone loves Sabine. But she's harder for me, I think. She's a strong, amazing heroine, but one that's really challenging for me. And I think, though, that's also the makings of a great book. So mm-hmm. There's so much to talk about with this one.
Right. So let's do a quick overview of the plot, and then we'll come back to Sabine, because I actually, as much as this, I should also qualify, even my not favorite IAD book is like one of the best romance novels I've ever written. So, like, let's just set that down. Say, like, everything's graded on a curve.
Okay. You did say one of the best romance novels you've ever written, though. And I would suggest that that's the most amazing Freudian slip ever.
Did I say that?
I think so.
Ever written.
Oh, well, okay. I hope so. We'll go back to the tape.
One of the best romance novels I've ever written. One of the best romance novels I've ever written. One of the best romance novels I've ever written. When we left Rydstrom, well, actually, first things first, last week, our last episode, we talked about Cade and Holly and their book, which is called
Dark Desires After Dusk.
You can't see Jen, but Jen's very proud of herself. So the title here, Kiss of a Demon King, is the first one that moves away from the structural titling that Jen figured out earlier in the podcast. This is the first one where there are no words shared between the prior book and this one.
And the trailing book, too, if you count Untouchable.
Yeah.
You do get Demon from the Dark after this. So I'm not really clear in what order they were written.
And you get it. The Showalter Cressley Cole duology is the Deep Kiss of Winter, so you do get the kiss part. Anyway, doesn't matter. Point is, the Cade and Holly's book, which is Dark Desires After Dusk, we talked about the fact that it feels unfinished, that story, because it's a road trip where we're moving toward getting the sword that will kill the bad guy and restore the throne to Rydstrom and replenish Rothkalina and, bolster the Veritas army. But mm-hmm. we don't see it come to fruition. Cade and Holly do their work, and then Rydstrom and Sabine have to finish it. And so last podcast, we had sort of talked about the fact that maybe we would feel differently about Dark Desires After Dusk and about Cade and Holly once we had reread Kiss of a Demon King. And that absolutely happened for me.
Oh, absolutely. Like, I almost to the point where I think you and I were both like, should we go back and add a, like, an epilogue?
Yeah.
Where we mea culpa and say, oh, wait, no. Because I think in that sense, we talked a lot about Wicked Deeds at a, oh, Jesus. Whatever the second book is with.
No Rest for the Wicked.
Yeah, No Rest for the Wicked. And oh, Jesus, Sarah, whatever those books are called. So the one with.
What are we talking about? No Rest for the Wicked and Wicked Deeds on a Winter's Night.
Yeah, I think those two also function as a pair, but we didn't feel like there was that sense that you really needed to read Bowen and Marichetta's book to get. You know, it didn't really feel as incomplete in some ways. Mm-hmm. I feel like this one, they're really way more strongly paired. And I feel like I grow to like Cade so much more as I get the sense from Rydstrom for more of that backstory. Like, you get that other point of view.
Mm-hmm. And Cade also, we see so much of Cade at the end of this book. And maybe it's not so much page count Cade, but like, we see so much of Cade in the moment, in his standing sort of in on his feet, comfortable with himself, believing in himself in a way that we don't see it in the last book. And we know other things too, right? Holly's pregnant with twins. Like, they are happy. They are moving forward with their lives. Cade is happy and confident, and there's so much to love about the way this book puts a button on the last book.
And I think too, it's also really all romance readers want to revisit their old favorites.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very rare that you really get quite as much kind of character development for a previous couple in like another book like this without it sort of stealing the spot. I mean, I feel like it's just perfectly done. It's just the right amount of information. And it's giving us information, too, about Rydstrom, because, you know, Rydstrom's always been the cool, calm, collected one. And then Cade is the one who really, like, by the end of this book is sort of like, calm down, man.
Yeah.
Oh, what you doing in there?
Like, so Dark Desires After Dusk, Cade's entire internal conflict is, how am I going to basically, like, pay Rydstrom back for what I've taken from him? How am I going to return to brotherhood with him? How am I going to become his brother again and earn his love back? And we see that. And so the emotional push-pull in Kiss of a Demon King is very much about Cade having to choose between Rydstrom and Holly. Right. And then at the end, we sort of get this hint that he no longer has to choose between these two things. But that hint is only given to us through the very concrete sword. Right. Like, he gets to have both. He gets the sword and Holly. The sword is a stand in for Rydstrom. But in this book, we see Cade get Rydstrom. And that's a totally different experience. And I completely understand why she had to hold off on delivering that moment in that book, but it left readers, it left me at least, like, really wanting this book to do a different kind of job than a romance novel typically does.
Yeah. Do you know, on Twitter, it's is it Super Wendy? Like, Wendy the librarian?
Mm-hmm.
She wrote a really interesting, oh God, it was so good, and I'll link to it in show notes, explanation about, like, when the HEA is believable. And she was like, it's not just that the characters have to sort of be in a happy place. It's that the world must be righted. And I think the thing that was so destabilizing about the end of Cade and Holly's book is the world is not righted. Cade is still not in a good place with his brother. We don't know what's happening with Rothgalina. And so that HEA just doesn't feel as good as it does at the end. Whereas at the end of this book, we get the closure on the world being righted.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was just such a smart point. And I really, it's a way, it's just like this little piece of information that, you know, when an HEA isn't satisfying, but I'm okay with a couple, it's because something in their world isn't quite set yet. And I think that that's what this book provides for Cade, not really Holly as much, but Cade. And because we have to see that he's repaired not just his sort of own sense of self, but his relationship with his brother.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't happen until this book.
No,
and I think
and we
it's
have
brilliant.
To see, you know, remember also that in two books ago, in Naomi and Conrad's book, which is Dark Needs at Night's Edge.
Well done.
There's that moment that we talked about last episode where Nyx says to the two of them, like, Cade is going to have to give up. Basically, she says, do you choose your mate or do you choose Rydstrom's crown? And Cade chooses Rydstrom's crown in that moment. And interestingly enough, like in that moment, Rydstrom chooses his crown and says, and yeah. I might add through this whole book, The Kiss of a Demon King, that Rydstrom continually chooses his crown, continually chooses his people yeah. and the well and the house and the land and the everything, right? He has to. He has this like deep abiding loyalty to his... I mean, he's the heir, right? Like, he has no choice. This is all he's been born to do, is protect Roth-Kalina, and he hasn't been able to do it. And but what we see at the end of this book is Rydstrom saying, I choose love, one, right, over right. everything else. But I also choose, I still can choose Roth-Kalina because I choose you, Cade. I trust you. With the future of this land, should something terrible happen to me, which he fully expects to happen.
Well, and also a big part, a fascinating part of the story is that Sabine turns out to be the exact right queen for Roth-Kalina. Mm-hmm. And so Rydstrom can't choose Roth-Kalina without also admitting that he needs his queen, that they, you know, his land is never going to be as whole or as healthy or as productive or as modern as, I mean, we get that return to modernity, right?
Thing.
As it would be without her presence in mm-hmm. his life and in the lives of his people. And I think that that, in that sense, this book is really fully satisfying in a way that the previous book, like, left me hanging.
Yeah. So all of that is to say, listeners, that... we were right. And you should definitely,
right.
if you're, you know, if you're listening ahead of your reading, or I don't know what, I don't know why yeah. you would be listening ahead, but if you are, or if you've not started your reread and you're just listening because you love these books before and you do decide to do a reread these back to back.
Yeah.
As Jen said, we went around and around on how to tackle this. But now I sort of wish, in hindsight, I wish that we had, you know, done a double episode for these.
Yeah, yes, and I'm going to say, though, like, counterpoint, this is how also they were written. I mean,
yeah.
we looked it up. We were like, people waited.
People waited 7 months. Cade and Holly's book came out in May of 2008, and Rydstrom's book came out January of 2009. They waited 7 months for the finish. I mean, fine, but we don't have to.
And we don't think. Hashtag blessed.
As it is, I can't believe I started this series before it was over, because now I'm just like tortured by the wait.
Oh, waiting is terrible.
I know. And I know that my readers are tortured by the wait for my books too, but I didn't, like, you know, leave anybody burning in a fiery tunnel or anything. Cressley.
Try it. Try it with your next book. See, report back on how that goes for the Sarah McLean readers out there.
Oh my They're God. Gonna love the it. Amount of hate mail I would get. So, okay. I want to talk about modernity. Because I do think that this is, I mean, we keep coming back to it, right? But Roth-Kalina, I mean, it's been left alone for hundreds of years, right? In the hands of this, like, evil wizard, sorcerer, not Groot, Omort.
The Deathless.
Omort, okay. Oh, wait. I was going to do an overview of the plot of this book.
You know what, though? I think we could make it really short.
Yeah. All right, so if you're reading with us, you know where we are, right? Cade has returned with the sword that can kill Omort the Deathless, who is a sorcerer, who is sitting on the throne of Roth-Kalina, which is by all rights and biology, Rydstrom's. So Rydstrom and Cade have spent the last X number of hundreds of years looking toward taking this throne back. And here we are. Rydstrom is about to help at the very beginning of Cade and Holly's book. He's supposed to go and meet Cade and go with Cade to get the sword. And instead, he runs his car off the road because a beautiful woman has tempted him. He nearly hits her and he swerves to avoid her. He runs his car off the road. She tempts him through the mist in sort of the bayou of Louisiana into a prison cell in another land.
It's Rothgalina, right? It's a portal right back into his own dungeons.
Right. So there we meet Sabine, Queen of Illusions. And Sabine's magic, she's a sorceress, and her power is to make people see things that are not there, literally to create illusions.
Yeah, and it's not just like vision, right? It seems pretty full. It's like entering the Star Trek holodeck, right? Like, so you smell it and you see it, and it's like completely 360 degrees around you. And this is, she's also Omort's half-sister.
Right. And the sister, the full sister of Melanthe, who we discover at the end of the book is the Queen of Persuasion. And that will become relevant. Melanthe and Sabine have been pursued by reckoners for hundreds of years. Thousands of years. No, 600. Sabine has been, they've been alive since the last succession. It's been 500 years. And they were chased as children. They've been in hiding in Rothgalina where the Reckoners can't find them. Omort has been told by prophecy that Sabine will be his wife, half-brother. It's pretty gross, you guys. There is some like a little content warning here on like the backstory of Sabine, I think, and Omort. Like there's definitely a kind of unsettlingly vile relationship between the two of them. Omort is a vile, vile character. Probably the most vile character of this. I mean, I may change my mind over the course of the next however many books, but certainly so far, we haven't seen
And I think part of the thing that makes him so villainous, and I think there's two things. One is he's very close. He's not just like a distant bad guy, right?
He's very present.
Yeah, he's very present. And he also, he controls Melanthe and Sabine with a poison. And essentially, the way the poison works is you don't feel it until you're essentially detoxing from it. So they are tied to him. If they ever leave Rothgalina, they have to return every 2 or 3 weeks because if they don't get this poison, is it Morpheus? Something like that, right? That might be wrong, but whatever. You know, and that part's really interesting because the diabolical nature of sort of the poison isn't present until you, I don't know, like it's almost like we talked about addiction with Conrad, but this is almost like an anti-addiction. It's very interesting the way it's
works. From a purely writing perspective, it's brilliant, right? This concept that you would be poisoned and not know you were being poisoned until you were no longer being poisoned. Like,
right.
But I kept coming. First of all, you're absolutely right. This is part of why he's so vile. There's something like deeply insidious and incredibly troubling about this idea that family, right? Because we're also talking about a series that is all about family, and particularly these two books, right? These are this duology is about brothers and children and sisters and found family. You know, Holly finds her real family. We start to see the creation of the Vertas army underneath Nyx, which is a family. And Cressley keeps coming back to this, right? Like, we've just come off of 3 books about Roth brothers. So it feels very much like a betrayal for the reader. Like, as you're reading, it feels like suddenly you've met a family member or you've found a family that is deeply disturbed. right? And it's perverted in all the ways, in every definition of the word perverted, right? And so you have this brother figure who's also a little bit of a father figure because he's patriarchal in many ways, and he has been damaging these girls for their entire life. He's been poisoning them. He poisoned their mind, and like you said, you don't know that you've been poisoned until you come away from it, and you have to work through the pain of detox, which is almost impossible. And I kept
even kill an immortal, right?
Right. And I kept wishing that we had Adriana Herrera with us, because it felt like domestic violence to me so purely. So it was such a clear. It's a clear sort of metaphor for me. I mean, it's not just a metaphor. It's literal. But it's also just this sort of really intense reflection of what it is to be a child in a home where you are raised with this kind of abuse, where you're not actually sure that it's going on at all until you're just in it and you're so far into it that it's created you, right? It's in your bones.
When Adriana and I talked about domestic violence and the smart bitches, like, one of the things was how dangerous the most dangerous thing for women in abusive homes is the escape. That presents the absolute most dangerous time. And so the poison is like a literal manifestation of that. Mm-hmm. For her to leave, it will literally kill her. And I think the way that it impacts her psyche, you know, I mean, I'm not a shrink, but like the way that she responds to people, the way that she responds to Rydstrom, her determination is only to save herself and her sister, which again, like the whole domestic violence angle, that felt very real to me. She was had a survivor's mentality,
right?
And she could not care about things like Rydstrom's feelings. He was just an obstacle to her getting what she needed, which was to escape her Omort safely with Melanthe.
And so what we end up with is a heroine who is deeply, deeply beloved by IAD readers, but mm-hmm. who is incredibly unlikable. And I hate that term, but I want to talk about it because I think I think for every reader who stands Sabine purely, there is probably a reader who cannot deal with her.
Yeah.
Because, so Sabine, the Queen of Illusions, has witched one of our heroes, right? Rydstrom has been set up as a hero for many books. He saved Mariketta from the incubi. He was heroic during the Naomi and Conrad book. There has never been a moment where we haven't seen Rydstrom act in pure, unadulterated loyalty to good. And we end up here with Sabine bringing him into her lair, for lack of a better term, because we don't know the full story of her relationship. What we know at the beginning of this book is that she is Queen of Illusions. She is the half-brother to, like, the most evil character in the series. And there is speculation that she has had some sort of relationship with this man, even though we do know at this point that that's not true because she is a virgin. Her virginity must be saved for Rydstrom, who is her fated mate. Right. So it's also an enemies to lovers story. And so Rydstrom gets into this, you know, essentially a dungeon, and witched chains come back.
Yeah.
He does not gnaw his leg off.
No.
Because he can't. And he's tied to a bed.
And I thought it was hard to read.
It's tough.
It's hard to read, not just for like consent issues, which I think are plentiful, but, you know, you're used to some softness.
Yep.
For the main characters towards each other, and they are hard.
Well, this is one of those fate of mate stories. And is it the first one, really, where they truly hate each other at the start, right? So fate has thrown them together. And Sabine says she doesn't believe in fate. And Rydstrom is deeply connected to fate. For him, fate is everything because he demons get one single mate, and he knows. He knows the moment he sees her that she's his mate.
Well, and I'm going to say the other thing that I think he also really hates about her is that she makes him question his goodness, right? Like, Rydstrom's this, like, I'm a noble, good character, and she thinks he's a chump, right? Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. she is constantly like, what are you talking about? Like, you know, and I think that that's the other thing that he profoundly hates about her. It's not just that she has him chained up in a bed and he's powerless, but that she also makes him deeply question what everything he believed to be true, not just about himself, but also back to Cade, like, right, who Cade is, what Cade owes him. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's another really destabilizing part of their relationship is that she is constantly like, you think you're so good, but mm-hmm. maybe you're not.
Well, and I think this brings us back to this question of unlikable heroines, right? I don't use that term ever. I mean, I feel like when people say I've written unlikable heroines, I mean, I'm taking back the word here because I've written unlikable heroines. I've certainly gotten the reviews and people don't, you know, found my heroines unlikable. And what typically happens is that people find heroines unlikable who refuse to cow to heroes immediately or who refuse to cow to others immediately. Selfishness and like self-preservation and self-confidence are often the hallmarks of an unlikable heroine. And Sabine is all of those things, right? She is, you know, I've said this to you before, but I feel like at the very beginning of this book, Sabine is really dormant in terms of her emotions have been so deeply suppressed because of the life that she has been forced to live over the last few centuries, that her cold, calculating activity on behalf of herself and her sister is pure, pure loyalty, but only to the two of them, and everything else is sacrificed. I would add, Sabine knows from page one of this book and has known for hundreds of years that Rydstrom is her only shot at love, right? And chooses and puts it, I mean, this is irrelevant to her. She chooses her life and future over any, technically, she chooses her and Melanthe's life and future over her own happiness.
Well, and in that way, it's kind of like when Nyx asks Rydstrom, which would you choose? She never asks Sabine that, but it's pretty clear what Sabine's choosing. And I think that's also part of the domestic violence angle. What man is going to convince her that he is trustworthy, that he is going to do what he says, that, right? Like, there's no way that she would trust anyone after Omort, except Melanthe, who essentially has lived through it with her, right? Mm-hmm. They have a shared, the shared past, and that's all that really matters to her. And I do think that that's why, ultimately, although I found her behavior kind of hard to reconcile, I also think that this is really a book about, like, radical forgiveness, right? Or radical acceptance. Mm-hmm. And that, like, we just are what our pasts make us. And if you really believe that to be true, then there's no way that Sabine, given what she's gone through, which is not just what she's done with Omort, but these many times she's been killed and brought back to life, she is not going to be any... I mean, she's hard as a diamond for a reason. And ultimately, she wouldn't be a believable character if she was anything but, like, a shards and shards and shards and shards of glass.
And I think one of the themes in this book that I kept coming back to was this theme of motherhood and the relationship between mother and child. Because this is – so – again, and I'm going to keep referring to it as a duology because I do think the two books belong together. In Cade and Holly's book, there's, you know, obviously Holly is about to have a warrior of – she's – Holly is the vessel, right? And she's about to birth a warrior of either complete good or complete evil, right? So by the end, we know that Holly is about to birth a warrior, two warriors – of pure good, right? To fight on the side of the Veritas. We know Sabine is about to have a child too, and the child will be born of Rydstrom, because it must be, in order for the kingdom of Rothgalina, for the denizens of Rothgalina to accept this child, it has to be an heir to Rydstrom, to the kingdom. And we also know that this child is about to open something called the Well of Souls, that this child's birth will open this Well of Souls that is sort of a mulligan. There's no...
Right.
It's another thing that Cressley puts on the page and, like, potentially will need it in the future, right? But every faction of the lore has a view of what this thing might be. But that's kind of all irrelevant, because Sabine... What's relevant is that Sabine having this child coming from Sabine, is an important piece of this puzzle, right? It has to be born of her. The prophecy is that it will be born of her, and that she will, whatever comes of it, of this child, whatever comes of this child's birth is going to be Sabine's responsibility. So she's sort of decided, I'm going to have this kid. I'm going to get rid of all these other men. This horrible, like, Omort's going to go and Rydstrom's going to go and I'm going to be queen and mm-hmm. I'm going to start fresh, right? And at the same time, there are all these echoes of motherhood, right? So she starts to think about this child and her responsibility to the child and her responsibility with her child, like almost like legacy building, right?
Yeah.
And then you start to see these flashbacks of their mother teaching them how to survive, right? How to live in the world. And there's a whole nother, the sorcerer, I have a whole nother obsession with gold in this book, and Sabine's mother has taught her constantly, like it was drilled into their heads that they protect gold, that gold is the most precious thing that they could possibly have. Again, it feels so modern. My mom, growing up, all my whole life, my mother would talk to us about how, like, she saved, like, my mother saved money. Like hid money around the house. She had hidden accounts. She had, like, and when I got married, she pulled me aside at my wedding and she said, you should always have an account, like a go bag, like a go account. And this, like, sort of, this is such a female way, I think, of thinking about, like, money as power and money as your potential for escape. Like, with money, you can get out, right? Should you need to. And I think that's really interesting. And the fact that Sabine's mother is the reason why that exists. And then there's a child in this book. There's another child. There's an orphan child.
Right. Yeah. And I thought that was fascinating because, of course, Sabine loves this boy, but pretend she doesn't, right? Like, she calls him names and, you know, but, like, it's everyone else sees how she feels about him. And it's a really, like, poignant sort of, like, unraveling of her, right? Because when she can nurture someone else, it's this signal that she is, like, letting go of the fierce control she needed to, like, escape Omort. And now she has, like, this room, this tiny little bit of room in it for someone else other than her and Melanthe.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's funny because we are talking about just, like, kids in general. And then in Caro's book, which is, you know, we get the novella next. But in Caro's book, there's also a child that must be protected. And so this is, like, a really interesting, like, the child that you're destined to have, the child that comes across you accidentally, and then the child that's in your care and that's your responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really interesting how, like, motherhood or, like, motherly instincts and fatherly instincts, parenting instincts, really come into play in all of those different scenarios.
I also think part of the joy of that, so I don't really have opinions about motherhood in books or children in romance novels. It's, but I think there's a moment where Sabine can also mind dreams, right? She can actually enter a person's head and,
right, like some projection kind of thing happens.
And show them and see or show them their, like, deepest fear. Like, it's one of her most powerful tools. Again, she has no special, She doesn't have super strength. She's no, like, sorcerer. I have no special powers physically.
But she's pretty scrappy. But, she's like, that's strong, because she's learned to be that way.
Exactly.
Right?
But she's certainly not as strong as many other characters in the lore. And so her defense mechanism is to be able to show you your nightmares. Therefore, she can also show you your dreams, right? Your hopes. And at one point, she mines Rydstrom's actual dreams as he's dreaming, and she sees him see her with a child, with their child, their fated child. And it's really powerful. It's a really poignant moment. She's shocked to her toes, and we are too, right? As readers, Kate Claiborne, hi Kate, we're mentioning you again. She texted Jen and I, you know, not long ago while she was reading, and she was like, there's a kid in this book. And this is a sort of shocking addition to the IAD world. These two books feel like they're like the pinnacle of that family story.
Well, and to me it kind of makes sense, because I mean, we've talked about immortality a lot, but what's your immortality worth if you don't have family? So we get a lot of family, like in terms of siblings, but we know that the accession brings people together as well. And that, like, for many, many couples, the natural outcome of that family thing is going to be children. And certainly not for all of them, but and I think sometimes it surprises some characters the way they feel about kids. I think that this, in that sense, I think it's a kind of a trilogy with Caro's book, like sort of bookending it, which is, you know, like, children come into our lives in unexpected ways. Even, you know, like, and that's kind of with all of them, like, you're going to have one. Oh, no, it's twins. Here's this boy. Here's, you know, so I do think that there's some ways in which if you're talking about immortality and your immortal life, is there still a desire or urge to have children or to have progeny or to pass on your IAD DNA or whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's like an interesting, I don't know. It feels like it has to happen in this section too, because if we're talking about deathlessness or like dying, then new life is its like natural other, right? Like it makes sense that would like counterbalance all the talk of like real actual death that could happen to these immortals. Well, of course, then you're going to bring up new life too.
Sure. And also this idea that like this, it reflects the poison too that's happening constantly with her, is this idea that she could die at any time.
Right.
She's literally she is always being prepared for death. And at the same time, she has literally been kept ready for life her whole life. So that dichotomy is really interesting. And then of course there is the sort of ultimate conflict, which is Sabine is kind of a bitch, and you don't think of her as being maternal. She's
right.
she is none of the classic traits of, you know, of motherhood at all. And then suddenly, of course, she's the one who cares the most about it.
And I think that's interesting, because there's a lot of things still, though, that like I have a big like question marks about. Like, her and Melanthi have some servant/slaves.
Yeah, I don't love that. They have slaves, and they never call them by anything but slave, which I sort of was like, oh, she has slaves. I don't love that, but I'm sure she's going to be like friendly with them and kind to them, and she's decent with them, but like they're still slaves. She does release them at the end. She frees them.
It's really kind of gross. Like it's
very
Gone with the Wind, like the way that we're supposed to sort of believe that because they care so much about their slaves, they're like good masters.
It was
really it's kind of like how I feel about like Harry Potter and the House Elves. It's like, oh God, why are we doing this? But I think the reason I bring it up too is because one of the most like a scene I'd like us to talk about, because I'm really curious about what you'd think as a writer. I know kind of how it felt as a reader, is one where in a it, like a they have a fight, I guess, whatever. She's furious and she is still in the driver's seat.
Well, it's cat versus cat, right? The whole book is cat versus cat. Two incredibly strong people fighting the whole way with fate sort of pushing them together.
But she like flounces out and she's really pissed. And she is going to have these male slaves bathe Rydstrom. And it's kind of it is homophobic, I think. There was some, it, you know, he clearly is really, he views it as violating, right?
Yeah, I agree with you that I felt that way. I was like, oh, what's happening here? This is not great. At no point is it about the fact that the slaves are male.
Well, except to Rydstrom.
Is it to him in the book?
I mean, she says, essentially, from what I remember, like, I know he'll hate this.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
Right?
I mean, but it is absolutely a violation. Maybe, I mean, it doesn't really matter. I'm trying to parse all the reasons why it felt squicky.
Yeah. Well,
for me, it felt squicky largely because of consent.
Here's my thing. I feel like Cressley as an author is really fearless. And I feel like we've talked a lot about how she will, like, if she sets up the play, she's going to play it. And this is a scene where I felt like she balked. Because it happens off stage. We get this, like, Sabine saying, like, oh, I was going to call them back, but before I could, Rydstrom essentially fought them off. He's drugged, but in previous scenes where he's been drugged, he's been out. And in this scene, it's just like he's still aware. And I found myself wondering, and maybe this is like a question like to a writer, right? To you, is like, what do you do when your character is going to do something that you yourself as an author do not have the will to put on the page?
I think this is a tricky situation. I'm 100% with you. It doesn't work the way I think. I don't know if it was, I don't know how it was intended to work. It's one of the rare moments in these books where I couldn't see the purpose of it, because we haven't seen, so, okay. Sabine and Rydstrom are at each other's throats through most of this book, right? We should say immediately following this scene, Rydstrom escapes, steals Sabine, takes her back to his lair, ties her to a bed, and then proceeds to, like, continue the whole experience there. So, I mean, what I want to say is that it doesn't work. I don't know what it was intended to be. I do think it's very clearly marked on the page that Sabine never intended it to get as far as it does, but I don't know that that matters. It's one of those situations where I can't go back to 2009 and read it then with the lens from 2009. So, which maybe would have mattered. Like, maybe that would have changed the thing.
Yeah.
I think that in this particular case, though, it was one of those moments where I would imagine, I'm like, what the hell do I know? Because I didn't write these books. But I would imagine that she was thinking, like, how do I ramp it up? Right? Because what the beauty of this book is that every time the two of them get to a place, it's so peaked and valleyed, right? The entirety of their torture relationship is sexual, right? It's all edging. Every moment. So they can't have actual physical intercourse until they are married. And in order for them to get married, Rydstrom has to take a vow. Speak a vow aloud, which he refuses to do for the first part of the book. So there's a lot of like sexual energy and sexual edging that's going on, and it's ramping up. And then every time it sort of comes to a peak, it then valleys into a conversation where the two of them start to become, you know, into each other. Like, they start to know each other and care, like, oddly care for each other. And then it peaks again and valleys, right? It's really interesting. It's a masterclass in how to, like, continually amp up conflict. This is the moment where the entire story turns on its head and Rydstrom is motivated to
Like, she's gone too far.
Rydstrom loses his nobility right after this and then ends up being the villain of the last, of the, you know, second third of the book. So as this is happening, it feels like, well, how could I do, like, as a writer, right? One of the questions we ask all the time is, you know, what's the worst possible thing that can happen? Do that. And, like, maybe that's it. But I don't see any evidence early in the book that this is the worst thing that can happen to Rydstrom.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. And that's the part, I guess, that, you know, and that's okay. I just wanted us to talk about it.
It no longer works. I will give you that. It no longer works. And, you know, you're right. It is a, it's clearly a very, it's intended to be a sexual experience. I don't think it would have worked at all if she hadn't thought to herself, I'm going to stop them. Right. If it was done fully with intent to let it go forward, Sabine would have been lost to readers, I think. She has this moment where she thinks, I'm going to stop it. And then she doesn't stop it, right? Because something else happens. And I think we are meant as readers to see that as, well, it wasn't so bad.
Right.
Whether or not that works is a different thing entirely.
So, yeah, I mean, we texted about it with Kate and you and I really wanted to talk about it. And I just think it's like a, you know, it just feels like a scene, like I said, where I really see in a way that I'm not used to in these books, Cressley pulling back from the scene, Sabine pulling back from the scene, right?
Everybody's pulling back from it because it's terrible. It's a terrible thing to do.
Yeah.
And so at the same time, I feel like, I mean, it's real ballsy. You don't know where the edge is as a writer until you're there.
Yeah.
And that's not a defense because, I mean, we're like, we all have to take responsibility for what we've put in a book. But, I mean, I wish I were more courageous sometimes.
It's interesting. It's just an interesting moment in the book.
Also, I would just say we're about to come up on Lothair and McGreeve and a lot of heroes. I want to come back to this, Jen, like in future episodes, because we're about to come up on some heroes who do some really fucking awful shit to heroines, and we forgive them, right? I mean, what Lothair does to his heroine is unacceptable.
Yeah.
On a number of levels, and we are like, Lothair's the best, woo, right? Like, so I want us to, this is coming back to this question of, like, I want us to, like, really soul search on unlikability and what we won't stand for from heroines, but we will stand for from men, heroes.
I mean, I think that's a really good point. And I think it's interesting that not only are we balking, but like I said, it felt like Cressley did too.
Yeah. Well, wait a second. Also, yeah, okay. I'm sorry. I'm changing my whole mind here. I'm talking myself through it now because we're going to go through Thronos, Declan Chase, Lothair, McGreeve. I mean, all four of those heroes do unconscionably bad things to their heroines.
Yeah, and they're, I love Lothair, but the other three are not my favorites. Like they're in the bottom for me.
I don't necessarily, I need to sort of revisit two of those four, but Lothair and McGreeve, I adore both of those books. And so I'm eager for us. I would like for us to just put this on the list for us to, like, check in every book on, like, have they been worse than Sabine or better than Sabine? Right? Like, because I don't want to hold Sabine up to a different standard.
Well, and it's a really interesting question about, like, not only are we holding her up to a different standard, but what is her standard for herself? And her standard for herself is, like, winning, right? Like, I have to get out of here, survival at any cost. And in that light, doing whatever it takes with Rydstrom is a price she's willing to pay.
Yeah. And I've like confused myself.
No, but I think that's what we're here for. I mean, I think these middle books really do ask a lot of really hard questions about how can you treat someone you're going to spend the rest of your life with, what's forgivable and what isn't.
Mm-hmm.
When you do make a massive mistake, what kind of restitution is required? How do people change when they make mistakes? What does it mean to have parity and payback? Is revenge the same thing as justice and fairness? I mean, all of these books really start to grapple with it. And I think it's why this series, to me, this is a turning point in the series where I think that those first five or six books or however many are kind of standard paranormal fare. And this, to me, is a book that is entirely different and asking an entirely different set of questions.
Which is part of why I enjoy it so much. One of the things that we've been talking about is the Wicked Wallflowers spreadsheet.
Oh, yeah.
So Wicked Wallflowers, for those of you who are just learning about it, the Wicked Wallflowers, which is a sister podcast of ours, they have loved IID as long as we've loved IID. And Jenny is going to join us right after this and talk about Sabine and Rydstrom. And one of the things that they are doing is they have a public Google spreadsheet where readers can just rank their favorite heroes and heroines in the series. And one of the things that I think is really fascinating about this is you get to sort of have a real sense of who loves what and where the similarities are, you know, in the way that heroes and heroines are grouped. However, what's missing from that spreadsheet is the love of a book versus the love of the hero and heroine. And I think this is one of those books where I probably don't love the hero or the heroine as much as I love others in the series, but I do love this book. I love the way she wrote this book.
It's like a fascinating look into the psyche, the collective psyche of IAD readers.
Also, we get a lot of horns in this book.
Yes.
And I do love a horn, as we know.
I was all about the horns until you sent me all those wackadoodle photos. And then I was like, none of this is sexy. Although...
False. Tim Curry as the Darkness is super sexy. I am not joking. I'm not.
Yeah. I forgot, though, if there's any comics readers out there, Saga is an amazing comic. And the hero at the beginning, he's a horned guy and he's like super cute and they have a cute little horned baby.
So I think that this is a place where we need to put out a call to our listeners because we seem to be at an impasse on what these horns look like. So if you have a picture or a drawing, if you'd like to draw us, if you feel arty today, like if you'd like to draw us what you think these horns look like and just tweet us the picture or post it on Instagram, or like you can secretly send it to us on Instagram and we'll post it on our Instagram. You can go to our Instagram feed, which is Faded Mates Pod, and look at the horn photos that I flooded Jen's texts with the other night. But let us know what's sexy, what's not sexy, what do these horns look like? We put it on the list for Cressley when she joins us for Q&A. We're going to get to the bottom of horns, but I still think horns are sexy. I think being able to steer using horns is super sexy.
It's pretty sexy.
I'm still there.
Well, speaking of sexy, we should introduce our guest today because she is really, I think both of us are blown away by how interesting and compelling her take on Sabine is, and her, what a personal connection she has to it, which is something we've alluded to, but I think it's a great interview and we're really looking forward to having Jenny join us for what's now turning into like a super-sized Kiss of a Demon King episode. Fine. I regret nothing.
It's like a Babysitter's Club summer spectacular. Did you read those when you were young?
Yes, I sure as hell did. Scholastic Book Club forever. I want to have a Scholastic Book Club for like Faded Mates.
That's a good idea. We'll call Pocket. Hey, Pocket. We want to do a special Faded Mates sale. Okay, well, so without further ado, this is our interview with Jenny. Well, welcome to Faded Mates, Jenny. We're so excited to have you.
I'm excited to be here.
Did we meet through IAD? I feel like we've known each other for a while, but like IAD is really like how we became fated mates.
It's the glue that holds us together.
That was when we kind of all knew we were a coven, where it was like, yes, this. Like, we are a little bit insane about this, and you're my people.
When Jen and I decided that we were going to do this podcast and commit a year of our lives and all of your lives to this, we knew instantly that we, of course, needed to have you and Sarah on. And so tell us how you came to IAD, and let's talk, too, about the fact that you were instantly like, this one, Kiss of a Demon King.
Well, and you had to fight for it. Like, I actually think there was, like, a face-off moment where I was like, okay, Thunderdome this out. Prove to us that you should be the one to talk about Sabine and Rydstrom.
Yeah, I threatened to take Joanna's Shoup out. I was like, this is my book.
And that's fine, because Joanna Shoup is going to come on and talk about Bonkers Romance with us another time.
Yeah, and that's great, because I got Sabine and she's mine. my reading of IAD is tied to my co-host Sarah, because we were roommates in college, and that's when we discovered Cressley Cole. And just, I'm trying to think how many books, I mean, it was about this one was when we started reading. So we binged up to this point and we're just like, this is bananas and we need more, and probably reread them all 6 times while we were waiting for each next one to come out. And so this particular book for me was personal, because that last year of college, I started working as a dominatrix and I had no idea what I was doing. Like, it's pretty much on the job training. Like, you just get thrown into a room with some dude and they're like, intimidate him and like make this, there's this like persona you're supposed to have, or like humiliate him or whatever. And you're like, I don't know how to do that. Like, these are the things I've been told my whole life I'm not supposed to do. And I had just read this book and I was like, I know how to do this. So I would literally sit in the dressing room and read her scenes before I was going into like a new session or something I was really intimidated by. And I was like, channel her, channel Sabine, like become that energy. And I would like use her lines sometimes.
I just feel like we could wrap up this entire podcast right now with that information. That's amazing.
A client would be like, you're so beautiful. And I would be like, I know. Just be like channeling her 100%. And that was exactly, I mean, she is a dominatrix. Like, that's her persona. So it was so perfect that it came into my life at that moment. And like, I think I very much crafted my Mistress Scarlet persona to match Sabine and tried to channel that as much as possible.
This is a good time for everyone to know that Jenny has written a book about this time in her life. And I don't know if it references IAD, because I actually just ordered it today. But it's called The Scarlet Letters, The Secret Year. No, My Secret Year of Men in an LA Dungeon.
Yeah. Hilariously, they made me take that reference out because they were like, this is insane and no one has any idea what you're talking about.
Excuse me.
Yeah, because everyone always asked me, like, how do you learn that? And I had there was half a chapter dedicated to like explaining that it, and it's nuts that like a romance novel was teaching me how to be a dominatrix.
Pull that out of the draft and put it on your website, because I, for one, would be super interested in reading that.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
You should.
All right. I will go find it. Yeah, if only Fated Mates had been out then, and I could have been like, see, all these other people are bonkers too, and they do know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, also, I'm sorry, but by then, like, it was a thing. And also, by the time you wrote your book, Cressley was a thing, so.
Yeah.
But anyway, thank you for publishing Jenny's book, St. Martin's, We Love You. So, okay, well, let's dive in then. So we know already that you have an affinity for Sabine, but here's my question. Did you have an affinity for Sabine before the job? I guess you wouldn't know, because you were reading it while you were on the job.
I think it came out like the year before I started working there. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I was just drawn to her. I mean, she's such an anomaly to anything else I had read up to that point, and just like owns everything about her personality and has been through so much, but like that's made her tougher and stronger and more ruthless. And yeah, there were just everything about her I was drawn to.
Which I love.
Jenny, one of the questions I was thinking like you might be really like well suited to talk about, and you sort of did at the beginning, is like, what are we to make of like Rydstrom and Sabine's like sex life, and her like pulling his I don't know, he wants to control her, but like he wants her to fight him. Like, did that seem similar or different from other heroes and heroines? Like, this was kind of a more BDSM book in a way.
Yeah, it's so funny. As I was rereading this time, I kept coming across moments that I was like marking or getting excited about. I was like, I wonder if Jen hates this because BDSM's like not your this cup was, of tea necessarily.
This was pretty light. I was into it. It was fine.
So, and I feel like these are the elements of BDSM that people sort of overlook and get caught up in the like, it's about beating people or it's about pain. It's really about power dynamics. And that's just masterfully executed in this book, like that power exchange between like who physically has power and yet often one of them can be chained up and still in control, and like that, the shadow between that and like a submissive and a dominant, where like you are playing at the dominant being in control, but in giving them that power, you're actually in control. And, you know, if you're doing it responsibly, you have a safe word and can always stop things. And ultimately, they're doing it to please you. So like, who is really, who has the power? And that's what I've always just found so fascinating about that world. And maybe is another one of the reasons that I love this book so much, because it's just constant, like it's flipping on its head. And like, you know, she gets into his head and can see that his fantasy is not only, you know, he doesn't just want to like have the power. He wants her to fight him. Like he doesn't want her to just give it up and like bend over and take it. And she's what I kept marking in my notes, that she's a Sam is what we would call it, a smart ass masochist. Like she eggs him on and at every turn is just like goading him into more. And he can kind of tell, but like as a dominant, it's really difficult not to get sucked into that, because you're like, oh, like you are getting me worked up. And
But if I
turn you over my knee and spank you, then I'm giving you what you want. So you are actually having power over me. And it just, yeah, it's fun. Sorry, what were you going to say?
No, I thought it was amazing. But I also thought, like, okay, we have joked extensively about how, like, everyone is preternaturally gifted at fucking in these books. Their first time having sex is terrible.
It's awful.
And she is like, you are terrible at this. And
first comment, like, I waited 500 years for this?
Yeah. Yes. Perfect.
Perfection. Yes. And I was like, and I just thought that was so amazing because it was so different from what we've seen in every other book so far.
And I love how her sister was like, well, it's probably just because he's big. Oh my God. And there's so much, but it's too big. It's too big. It's too big. It won't fit in this book, too.
So much.
And it's the first time of that. Like, I feel like this is the first of the books where there's like a real deal, it won't fit.
Maybe, but
Sabine is so different because she's like, oh fuck no, that's not gonna fit.
Like, that's true.
It is like, so somebody on Twitter was talking about this, and they called out the Sex and the City episode where Samantha is with some guy and he's like, oh poor me, like no one wants to sleep with me because, you know, it's too big. And she's like, please, I'm Samantha. What are you talking about? And then he takes his pants off and she's like, no, now we just have to be friends. It's too big. So yeah, what's amazing about it is that even, you know, and this is one of the hardest things to do when you're writing romance, is like sex has to change the dynamic of the story, but it can't change the character. Like you can't be like, oh, and now they had sex and she's like a totally different person now. And Cressley never does that, but it's really great that it's terrible sex to begin with.
Well, and I love that she's a virgin heroine, but she's not inexperienced. And when he like calls her out for that, or anyone calls her out for it, she's like, whatever, like I can give a blowjob. And I think I just appreciated that like sex is not all about penis and vagina.
Right.
So like she's probably been having better experiences, and that the first time that happened, she's like, this is not doing it for me.
Like, no, thank
you. I have not been missing anything.
I have a follow-up question to all of this, Jenny. Would we, because as I think both of you know, like my super romance kink is the alpha submissive, because it's very, and it's super rare, but I kept getting that feel here. Like, would we call Rydstrom an alpha submissive?
Ooh, I probably wouldn't.
No.
maybe it would make sense for what your definition of it is, but he is pretty clean cut dominant to me.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, whatever. It scratched my itch. So maybe it's maybe that's not what my itch is.
I think we may have even talked about this in the past, but like people tend to mislabel alpha and think it's this sort of like caveman thing.
Yeah.
And really it's the things that he constantly falls back on of like he wants to be protector and caretaker and nurturer. And like those are the traits that I see in a dominant. They want to care for their submissive. And like he likes that she's a Sam, a smart ass masochist. Like he wants some sass from her. He doesn't just want someone who's like, you know, please take me, as he's always had. I had a note to bring up the fact that when she dives into his head and projects his fantasies onto the wall, his fantasies are of her. And she makes the comment that, like, it could have been anything. It could have been, like, something really freaky. It could have been someone he was with in the past, or her with other women, or. And it's just, like, him with her. And this is really sad, but I remember at the time finding that really unbelievable. I didn't think you could be with someone who actually fantasized about you. And I was like, oh, that's, you know, like we all watch porn and whatever. And there's nothing wrong with fantasizing about porn or other people or whatever. But it just, I had never been with someone where I was their fantasy. And, you know, college Jenny was just like saddened by that. But now rereading it, adult married Jenny is like, fuck yeah.
Or, yeah, or like the part where he fantasizes about her, them with a baby, right? Yeah. About like those simple pleasures about being a family and like raising your kids. And
I just melted at that one.
Oh, God,
where,
yeah.
Like,
me too.
He's at the window and there's a storm on the ocean and he turns around and she's sleeping with their baby. And like,
yeah.
Oh, my God. I don't even like babies in romance. Barely like babies in life.
But I will tell you, you guys, the one time I remember Daryl really looking at me like he couldn't believe how beautiful I was when I was holding our baby.
Yeah, I'm going to kill that moment by saying I was reading that while I was up nursing in the middle of the night. And I went, fuck that fantasy. She's sleeping. The baby's sleeping. That's not a thing.
So can we do a limb count?
Well,
I don't know, Jenny, I don't know if while you were reading, you were counting a limb, like, count, but you could stay with us for it.
I was like, does his severed spine count?
I think so.
It wasn't actually removed.
I do. I marked it, and I made, and I marked the torso cracking open.
Yes.
So the ripping,
sure,
open of the torso.
It seemed like there were some limbs. And then I didn't know if it counted, because I think we've really only been counting main characters.
Mm-hmm.
But later on in the book, and I'm trying to find my notes. Oh, here it is.
It's Thronos.
Thronos's foot is severed.
And yes. And since Thronos becomes a hero, I think we should count it.
Yeah,
Jenny,
I think
do
so
you have
too.
Opinions on limbs?
I think you count it. Yeah.
I've forgotten about it. I was like, I guess I'm just counting the spine. What a disappointment. It was still in there. And then I was like, oh, good. Here's the foot. My other friend, Kelly, not Kelly, our, like, my best friend and button designer and logo designer, another friend of mine, Kelly, has been reading the Arcana Chronicles, mm-hmm, which is her YA series, which apparently is still pretty racy. And she said there's some lost limbs in there too. And did I want them to count? Did she want, you know, do I want her to count them? I was like, oh my God, what have I wrought?
That's so perfect. Yeah, I've read that series too.
So yeah, I had the same thing, the spine, the torso, and Thronos's foot as a bonus.
I actually questioned if the plucked organs counted as bonuses for this book.
Oh, interesting.
But it didn't happen on page, so I did not count them. It was like
a wreath of entrails.
Yes. Like, Merry Christmas.
This, you guys, this has been amazing. Jenny, I'm so glad you joined us for this.
I'm so glad. I love chatting with you guys.
And I'm also so glad that you have, that you saved the story of how you came to this book
for this podcast.
Oh, for our podcast.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go dig it up from past computer hard drive somewhere. But yeah, I'm sure it's been emailed to someone.
So Jenny and Sarah Hawley, who will be joining us for Dark Sky, I think, right?
No, Sarah Hawley is coming in for the Declan Chase special, Dreams of a Dark Warrior. Hello.
The Declan Chase.
We were like, special. Who the fuck is going to talk to us about this guy? Sarah Hawley.
New readers have not even come close to Declan Chase, and it's a thing.
It is.
It's a real thing.
Batshit enough that it's like Sarah's brand, that's her favorite IAD.
Agreed. So Jenny and Sarah Hawley host an amazing podcast. If you haven't listened to it, it is called The Wicked Wallflowers. You can go download it on your favorite podcasting app, just like you download us.
And yeah, if you love Jen and Sarah, and I know you do because you're listening, you could start with their episodes. In fact, yeah. They both have multiple episodes.
That's true.
So remember how we said at the beginning that you shouldn't start with Warlord Wants Forever because it's a novella and you just shouldn't. You should come back to us. We would bring you to novellas later. Well, it's our novella episode in 2 weeks. So your reading is The Warlord Wants Forever. There are two versions of A Warlord Wants Forever. Jen, what have we decided? We want them to read the most recent version.
Yeah, I think so. But so it's confusing. The original Warlord Wants Forever was part of a small anthology where there were like three books. One was like Jade Black and it was Cressley Cole and I forget the other person. We'll put it in show notes. If you happen to have it, don't buy it again. But then it got released separately as Warlord Wants Forever with like a sort of IAD cover. And you should, if you're buying it new, just get that one.
Yes.
Or from your library.
You should also know that if you read that old version, there are going to be some issues. And those issues have apparently been played with in the new version.
Can I tell you another fun fact, though, about Warlord Wants Forever?
Sure.
The original audiobook narrator for that was not Robert Peckoff.
I know, because I've listened to that audio. It was two narrators. It was a male narrator and a female narrator.
Well, and they had him re-record it. So I have listened to it with Robert Peckoff.
Nice. So. I might do that, too, because I didn't love the male-female switcheroo. Mm,
yeah,
I know other people do that, and I don't love it. And then the second novella is Cressley Cole's Untouchable, which is in a duology called The Deep Kiss of Winter. The second novella in that is by Gina. So added bonus, if you've never read a Gina Showalter book, you can read a novella by her there.
Am I the only one who calls it in my brain Frozen IAD?
No, but now that's what we're calling it.
Yeah.
For sure. So that's 2 weeks. You have two novellas. That's your homework. And then, Jenny, tell us, besides The Wicked Wallflowers, where else they can find you?
Yeah. I mean, you can find The Wicked Wallflowers on the various social media platforms. We are at WCKD Wallflowers because there's not enough characters to spell it out. And then you can also find me personally as Jenny Nordback. And my last name is Nordbak. There's no C. Everyone's brain wants to put a C in there.
Well, thank you for coming. Thank you for listening to Fate of Mates, everyone. Please, if you like this episode, make sure to subscribe and like us and review us wherever podcasts are sold.
Or given away for free.
Exactly.
That's an important clarification. Someone told me recently that they thought subscribe meant like purchase a subscription.
Oh. No, that's not true. We are free.
To be clear, subscribe does not mean you're paying anything. It's still free.
It just means it shows up automatically.
In your ear holes. Okay. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks.
I'm going to derail really quick. I made my husband listen on the way. We had like a 4-hour drive out to go camping, and I made him listen because I wanted to make sure I had like listened and knew what I was doing. And he was the same thing. He was like, this sounds so academic. Like, this is about, and then he was like, what the fuck is that? Like, he nodded his what? That went off the rails immediately.